Life has a melody guide. A rhythm of notes to become your existence. Played in harmony with God's plan. Time to do your part and realize your destiny.
Which is what exactly?
You are the guardian and protector of the new generation of God's children. First member of our family will be with us soon, guys. Time to make your choice.
But I don't understand what you're talking about. Really, I don't understand.
See the face with the shape of things to come.
Happy heresies, my beloved true seekers. Welcome to a dream of you, a dream beyond the dream of the Red King, a dream before you reach the farthest shores Ursula Le Guin wrote about, and it's called Coffee, Cigarettes, and Gnosis. Welcome on this approximately Saturday, December 1st, 2007, to the continuation of one of the greatest love stories ever imagined.
Nor what you love, nor what loves you. That's what I decided a long time ago.
Perhaps the greatest love story ever, for it has no origin and no end. An ageless romance beyond the seductive firewalls of time and space. It's the love story of two aeons searching for each other throughout the aeons. And by aeons, spelled A-E-O-N-S, we don't mean ontological entities per se, but divine potentials, personhoods, and fragments of the all. Higher, more supreme than any god, far more infinite than any universe, and more authentic than any reality. And these two aeons are Christ and Sophia, the reason and wisdom of the supernal source for all that is and all that isn't. At play, at love, and in curiosity, they have been the sublime instruments of the divine actuality and understanding itself.
We are star stuff. We are the universe, made manifest. Trying to figure itself out.
And you see, their love story is the story of the Gnostics, for we have been at play, at love, and in curiosity ever since we were aborted from the supernal source because of its insistency in experiencing imperfection. The saga of Sophia and Christ is our template for the inner recognition of our own divinity. The epic of Sophia and Christ is our roadmap for our celestial seed to ejaculate upward and outward towards the womb of light, where the cosmic symphony of the aeons and luminaries never ends. Think of Enya after a gray goose and red bull, or whatever type of ethereal music tickles your fancy.
And we can't argue with destiny now, can we?
We are the Gnostics. We write our own gospels and live our own myths. And we are myth itself, just like the myth of Sophia and Christ I more or less just made up. Or did I? Yes, my beloved true seekers, the myth is the method in Gnosticism. It is the means to an end and the end of all means. You've heard all about myth, the secret language of the spirit, before on this politically incorrect name show. You're hearing about myth right now at the Virtual Alexandria, and you'll hear much about myth again, like an echo of a distant dream containing all the answers you'll ever need to finally see the kingdom of the Father spread around the world like a healing mist.
It is a journey of evolution, adaptation, the journey we all take, the journey that unites each and every one of us.
But perhaps some of you aren't aware that myth is so closely tied to psychology, uncorrupted dogma, dream interpretation, mindful living, and other machinery to attain mental and spiritual wholeness. Although Joseph Campbell said that religion is myth misunderstood, we can easily say that psychology, philosophy, and theology are myth misplaced.
Did you see the memo about this?
Have I lost my mind? Yes, but that's besides the point. In fact, our guest today organizes all that I've thrown at you far better than this forgotten God could ever do. And this is Robert Lloyd, author of The Knowledge That Leads to Wholeness. His book is an ambitious, didactic, and well-written account of Robert's own mystical journey into godly self-awareness, utilizing the various prisms of myth misunderstood and misplaced. It's got it all. The Gnostic cosmology and scripture, the puissance of alchemy, the endless wells of understanding archetypes and individuation, and death psychology in an easy-to-understand mode. And this should be no surprise, since Robert is a therapist himself as well as a born forever Gnostic.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Like Karen Armstrong wrote about myth, it is, therefore, a mistake to regard myth as an inferior mode of thought, which can be cast aside when human beings have attained the age of reason. Mythology is not an early attempt at history, and does not claim that it tells our objective fact. Like a novel, an opera, or a ballet, myth is make-believe. It is a game that transfigures our fragmented, tragic world, and helps us to glimpse new possibilities by asking, what if? A question which also has provoked some of our most important discoveries in philosophy, science, and technology.
The universe is full of surprises.
And Karen, Robert, and I are in good company. The prisms of myth I've been talking about, psychology, philosophy, theology, and esoteric arts, have been used by the giants of mankind's history, including Plato, Buddha, Jesus, Shakespeare, George Lucas, C.G. Jung, just to name a few.
It's an honor to die at your side. It's an honor to live at yours.
They understood the futility of mundane reality in the charged manner that was mythology. And in a sense, they all understood the love story of Sophia, divine wisdom, and Christ, divine reason. For when those two finally get it on in the Gnostic bridal chamber and deep in the caverns of your soul, we experience things no eye has ever seen, hear things no ear has ever listened, and feel things that no heart has ever felt. A perfect example of the universal power of myth and the ageless romance that is our story as well as Sophia's is her repentance and cry for a lover in the Gnostic scripture Pistis Sophia, which translates more or less into ever faithful wisdom.
Light who has helped me, may thy light come down upon me, for thou art my shelter and I come to thee, O light, believing in thee, O light. For thou art my savior from the emanations of the tyrant, and it is thou who wilt save me from all his powerful threats. I will say that thou art the light which is on high, for thou didst save me, and thou hast brought me to thyself. And thou didst not allow the emanations of the rulers, which are my enemies, to take away my light. O light of lights, I have sung praises to thee, thou hast saved me. O light, thou hast brought my power up from the chaos. Thou hast saved me from among those that go down to the darkness. The light has become my savior, and it has turned my darkness into light for me, and it has rent the chaos which surrounded me. It has girded me with light. Sing praise to the light, and forget not all the powers of the light which he has given to thee. And all the powers within me sing praise to the name of his holy mystery, who forgives all thy transgressions, who saves thee from all thy oppressions with which the emanations of the rulers have afflicted thee, who has saved thy light from the emanations of the rulers which belong to destruction, who has crowned thee with light in his compassion until he saves thee, who has filled thee with pure light, and thy beginning will be renewed like an invisible God of heaven. In faith I have believed in the light, and he remembered me. He heard my song of praise. He brought my power out of the chaos of all the matter and the darkness below. And he brought me out, and he placed me in an aeon on high which is strong. And he has set me on the way which leads to my place. And he gave me a new mystery which is not that of my aeon. And he gave me a song of praise of the light. Now at this time, O light, all the rulers will see what thou hast done for me, and they will be afraid, and they will believe in thy light.
And by the way, I am, and I am Abraxas, the terrible God above God as the ancients knew him. Broadcasting through, you got it, the God above God dot cam, from the virtual Alexandra and his mortal incarnation of Miguel Connor.
Just admit you're stupid and don't know what you're talking about.
I'm stupid and I don't know what I'm talking about.
Make sure you've got some kind plant substance singeing your lungs and some toxic caffeine pumping your heart with lucid energy. And before the interview, throw some symbolic spittle at the politically correct mindset that is nothing but one of the spiritual castrating tools straight from hell used by Jehovah and his demonic workers' union.
I am eternal child. I am the eater of wolves and of children. And you are nothing.
Again, our guest is Robert Lloyd, author of The Knowledge That Leads to Wholeness, helping us understand the dynamics of myth and how it pertains to, as Stephen Heller calls it, psychospirituality. For more information on Robert and his ventures, please visit his website, robertcharlesloyd.com, or visit his online community at thepearl.org, a goodly source for Gnosticism with heavy C.G. Jung overtones. This is the Coffee, Cigarettes, and Gnosis interview. Today with us, we have Robert Lloyd, author of The Knowledge That Leads to Wholeness, and we'll be discussing this very eye-opening and erudite book. How are you doing today, Robert?
Very good. Thank you, Miguel.
Glad you made it. Okay, if I call you Bob?
Please do. Feel free.
Okay. Well, why don't we start? First of all, how did you become interested in Jung and his old friends, the Gnostics?
I started off as a patient back in 1981 with a Jungian therapist after my father had died, and my marriage wasn't working out, so I went into Jungian analysis. Basically, that analyst taught me how to pay attention to my dreams, which I never knew contained so much wisdom. And I subsequently went on to other therapists over the next 10 to 12 years. I had two other analysts, each of whom contributed quite a bit to my personal growth. So I would say that the work of Carl Jung in developing his analytical psychology probably saved my young life from a suicide from depression. And then further than that, it just captivated my own imagination about what life was all about. And I think I kind of got put on a path from my own inner work. Later on in life, I did go on to become a therapist, and I did my doctorate work at Pacifica Graduate Institute, which is really a community devoted to the work of Carl Jung and depth psychology.
And why did you decide to write The Knowledge That Leads to Wholeness, which seems to be basically a mythic story of your own adventure into self-knowledge, and it's also as well a map for others to follow? Why did you decide to write it?
I felt there was a need for a book that wrote about Jung's insights in a style that the Gnostics used themselves. I mean, I think the Valentinian Gnostics are a good example of a community that I relate to. They had to cope with, you know, the burdens of being surrounded by Orthodox Christians, and that, believe me, that's no easy burden to bear. But one of the ways they survived that difficulty was to learn the principles of allegory and how to allegorically interpret and even reframe the Orthodox creeds that were coming out and the Orthodox scriptures that were coming out. And I think that allegorical interpretation allowed the Valentinians to reduce the offensiveness of the literalism of the kind of the fundamentalist mind. Because you remember, these people were participating with Orthodox Christians in Eucharistic services, so they were rubbing elbows with people. Anyway, I felt it was a symbolic narrative would really capture the mythic mindset that characterized the Valentinians. It's just a different way of thinking. It's a different way of responding to the spiritual message. Allegory, I think, has the added advantage, too, of evoking an emotional response from people. You have abstract ideas, but, you know, what's your response to it emotionally? Does it move you? I think Jung was very clear in his statements that individuation was not just a matter of acceptance of abstract ideas, you know, like as if you could just, you know, give your agreement to a proposed statement and that would transform you. It wouldn't. He says over and over that individuation really involves the transformation of the whole person, and that includes the emotional responses of the person, you know, the emotional response to light, the emotional response to darkness. So I think that's why I wrote the book, because I had this experience of Jung in my own personal life, and I had an emotional response to it. I wanted to write a book that kind of contained that, because I hadn't seen any books that really had that side of it.
Bob, why are the Gnostics considered to be the first psychoanalysts?
Well, you know, Jung was referring to the Gnostics as psychologists, and I think in his essay, The Structure and the Dynamics of the Self, he quotes several different ancient teachers to give you a flavor of why he believed this, like Hippolytus, who said the knowledge of man is the beginning of wholeness, but the knowledge of God is perfect wholeness. Jung quoted Clement of Alexandria, who said, when a man knows himself, he knows God. And he quotes a teacher by the name of Menoimus, who said, you know, that we should abandon the search for God, but rather look for God by taking ourselves as the starting point. It's very psychological. Menoimus said, you know, learn who it is within you who makes everything his own and says, my God, my mind, my thought, my soul, my body. He said, learn the sources of sorrow, joy, love, hate. Then he said, if you carefully investigate these matters, you will find God in yourself. It's very psychological. I think these quotations show that Gnostic-oriented thinkers really accepted the validity of the subjective point of view as a method of searching and finding truth. It's a psychological dogma that we really can't, well, we have no power to navigate our lives safely through the treacherous waters of the unconscious unless we can look within at our own motivations, at our own perceptions and our feelings and responses to life. Without that inner knowledge, we really can't. We're going to be ruined by the unconscious because we ignore the unconscious at our own peril. It trips up the most talented, the most intelligent, and successful people of all time. And I think Jung was just basically saying that the ancient Gnostics perceived this fact. You know, they knew that recognition of the collective unconscious, which manifests in our life on a daily basis, is critical. And the subjective factor must be the starting point, if you will, for seeking truth. Because a lot of times too much emphasis is put on abstraction and objectivity. This is not a psychological approach, but the Gnostics did take it that way.
And how does the concept and myth play into all of this, both Gnostics and psychoanalysts?
Again, Jung felt myth was a mental therapy, you know, like reading a myth was not just reading a story about others, it's reading our own inner story, the truth of our own lives. And it's like a mental therapy for our own anxieties because, you know, when we don't have a groundedness to our being, we're out of touch with parts of our own being. This manifests in horrible, horrible events, you know, like the war we have going on now. It manifests in racism and all kinds of intolerances that people develop. But, you know, when the myths, when you go into them, you realize they illuminate the deepest truths of our own existence. They're about us. They kind of come out from a place outside of time and, you know, the timeline. It's sort of eternal truths. They put us in touch with our own forgotten past, you know, even before there was a history. And myths definitely put us in touch with a future that sometimes the future we cannot bear to think about or face. The myths put us in touch with that. If we read them correctly, we will perceive that our own human fate is being described. And each one of us, I think, can find the truth of our personal life in the context of myths. And Jung argued that reading them had a very healing and therapeutic effect because when you enter into a myth, as your own unfolding story, your ego, you know, your conscious mind is united with the unconscious. And this is a healing process of uniting the conscious with the unconscious. The myth leads us back to our unity of our total being.
And we were talking about the world and Carl Jung and individuation, mental healing, obviously a process you went through, Bob. But the charge or the polemic used against the Gnostics is that they were you know, world and flesh haters, but you mention in your book several times that that is incorrect. Why do you believe the Gnostics weren't world and or flesh haters?
Well, I believe that accusation was put onto us by people who did not understand the Gnosis. I mean, in general, you'd have to say, you know, as a principle, Gnosis cannot emerge from hatred. You know, they're two diametrically opposed realities. Remember now, the demiurge is the creation of the mortal mind, which is full of petty jealousies and revenge fantasies and hatred of the world, hatred of the body, you know. This seems to exemplify an unreflected psychological disposition. You know, it's the kind of thinking and the kind of feeling that develops when you do not reflect upon your experience. And this gives rise to the demiurge, which is a petty and selfish god figure, king figure. But it's a Gnostic principle that darkness really seeks to control and consume the light because, you know, that's the nature of darkness. It's as if the darkness is attracted to the light and desires to unite with it, but knows no other way to unite with it other than to steal it and to eat it. Pretty primitive, you know. But psychologically,
right.
I guess I could say that the unconscious will stay unconscious until the ego finally does its own heroic work of paying attention to the manifestations and relating to the manifestations of the unconscious. See, because now light operates totally different than darkness. And you could say light seeks to incorporate the darkness. It doesn't seek to destroy it. It's trying to incorporate it so that every part finds its place. That's really, you know, what individuation is all about. It's an organizing of all the many parts of our being into a cohesiveness, a wholeness, where all the parts touch each other, but they're touching without that fiery destructiveness that characterizes the human condition before the attainment of some degree of wholeness. I'd say Gnosis emerges not from it can't emerge from hatred, but it emerges from a humble and open mind to the very strange manifestations of the unconscious, including, you might say, the amazingly bizarre image of the human body.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's quite a paradox in itself. But if we have a student's attitude toward these paradoxical and perplexing manifestations, we tend to penetrate more to the heart of the reality. And Gnostics did penetrate to the inner reality of the flesh, of the body, and they knew how to distinguish between the illusion of the appetites and the illusion of the instincts and separate that up from the metaphysical realities behind, you know, the body, what really the body is revealing, something of a metaphysical nature. Now, you know, I will agree that Gnostics use hyperbole to stir up their audience. You know, they, you know, have to plead guilty to the fact that they did refer to the body as a tomb, and life in the material world is called being in a prison and things of that nature. But, you know, it really wasn't out of hatred for these things. It was an attempt to wake people up from the spell that is put on us by our sex drive, by our aggression, you know, fear, grief. People needed to wake up, and the Gnostics wanted to help them wake up to find the inner reality, the metaphysical principle behind the appetite or behind the instinct. For example, if you ask yourself, what is the metaphysical principle behind sex? If you carefully investigate sex, you arrive at the inner reality, which is the sacred marriage of opposites. And that's the key to wholeness. I don't take the view that the Gnostics hated anything. I think that's antithetical to what Gnosis really is all about. It comes out of a completely different mindset, which is attempting to integrate and not just repress.
Bob, why is the Gnostic myth of creation, especially the Valentinian account you portray in your book, such an important part of the process of wholeness?
Well, there's many treasures in in the creation myth. The Valentinian creation myth is a profound, profound myth, I believe. I do elaborate upon it a bit in my book. For one thing, just start with the God image that's presented in the myth. You know, it's a healing image. If you look at it, you have the depth and silence as the root of everything. This depth and silence is beyond all categories of thinking and beyond the rational mind. You know, all we can really do is recognize that everything we can think about and relate with comes from this ineffable source, you know, the eternal sea of unknowing. But it, the myth talks about how the depth and silence emanate a divine couple called mind and truth. And right here, you have a beautiful insight into human nature, because from the depths of mystery and silence within us emerges an image in our mind. You know, this happens to us every day. Out of nothing, all of a sudden there's an image. Even the Gospel of Philip talks about how truth did not come into this world naked, but clothed in the images and archetypes. So we can trust the images. It's saying, you know, we can trust the images that emerge in our minds because they're worthy of being related to. So right there you've got a beautiful kind of a juxtaposition. But the myth describes the order of creation in the world before time and space, and you've got these couples, these lovely divine couples being emanated. Mind and truth emanate word and life, and another couple, man and community. And then word and life emanates five more of those couples, and man and community emanates six more of those couples. And altogether, you know, we wind up with 30 divine beings, and they're paired off as couples, which is a very profound insight, because it expresses the idea of uniting the masculine and the feminine forces. The couples harmonize their desires, you know, they harmonize their will, and from that harmony they create. They create out of the pattern of unification. Now this is a type of individuation, right there again. I think all these loving couples, all together they form up a community called the Pleroma, which means the fullness. So this God image is profound. And this myth, it's a very healing myth for our fractured Western culture. Because, you know, instead of the God image of an isolated masculine king who, you know, he just can't tolerate any other god in his town, we have this image of a loving community. Think about that. The divine image is a loving community. Couples who are working together to harmonize their wills and, you know, from that create out of love. You know, what could be more needed in our sick culture than that image, I think.
Right, right. But where does Sophia fall into? What happens to Sophia in our head?
Well, that's where the myth talks about the necessity of a descent, you know, because everything starts off in this beautiful harmony of the fullness, and then that's act one. Act two is, you know, the necessity for a descent, and that's where Sophia comes in. Because she's passionate, you know. She's passionate to know her source. What we see is that she thinks her source is out there in the light that she sees, and which is a beautiful illustration of projection. Here again, projection is something we all do every day, and we can't help but do it. It's just the nature we got. And, you know, what we don't know, the unconscious, is put out there onto the world or onto people, you know, things we don't know about ourselves are put onto other people. And we believe that's true of other people. Actually, it's not necessarily true of them. It's more true of us. Sophia is modeling that whole thing that we do. So she projects her truth as outside of herself, and she doesn't understand that she's doing it. It's unconscious. And that leads her on an odyssey. She falls into the chaos of the parts below. And in that chaos, she has to, it's a heroic journey, isn't it? She has to learn how to deal with all the incredible changes that are coming her way. Remember, she's an immortal spirit that's suddenly trapped in time and space. And that would be like hell for her, you know? And the descent experiences teaches about ignorance and about all the things that we've been unconscious about. But we learn that, you know, when we act unconsciously, we're digging ourselves into a deeper hole. We can get stuck there. But we can also learn from the myth that if we focus on the light, as Sophia did, and work, you know, they happen to be stuck in darkness at the present time, but we can correct our course. You know, we're not fated to stay there if we don't want to. From Sophia comes the material world. I mean, because in her grief and pain and suffering, physical elements get created, come into being from that. And it kind of shows you that the world of matter is, I guess you could say, a manifestation of God's own painful initiation and growth in consciousness. It's God grows in consciousness too. And it's as if the physical world is like a developmental marker on God becoming more united in being. And, you know, and so that's important because then we can then appreciate the physical world as holding the image of cosmic individuation. Everything is moving towards wholeness if we see it that way. So therefore we can transcend the illusion created by matter. We cannot get stuck there. We can recognize it as a temporary condition of a changing consciousness, you know. So Sophia's myth of descent is incredibly important for us to understand because it reveals our own journey and where are we going to go. Are we going to get stuck in the darkness or are we going to work with the parts to be able to find the light and to be liberated? And that's what Gnosis is liberation.
Bob, you just mentioned Sophia's initiation, but psychologically, what exactly is the benefit of the concept of initiation?
Initiation, you know, it occurs in usually a ceremony or a rite, some kind of a ritual. These rites of initiation, they are, you might say, attempts to abolish the separation between the conscious mind and the unconscious, because the unconscious is the source of life, you know. These rites offer a person a reunion with that source, that native soil of our being. Mircea Eliade said that man becomes himself only after having solved a series of desperately difficult, even dangerous situations. This is what the initiation rites and mysteries offered. The candidate would experience an ordeal, you know, a death experience, and it could be frightening, but later would awaken to a qualitatively new and different sense of identity, different sense of meaning in life. You know, the question about why we have to travel into the underworld to individuate is important because it really gets to what the indwelling divine spirit is trying to accomplish while we're here in the human body. It really goes to that, the whole heart of the matter. The human body and the mortal realm of time and space are really initiation ordeals for the spirit, as we kind of saw with Sophia, you know. The spirit's being transformed by the ordeals of limitation. Just having time and space around is good enough. But more than that, the spirit is really trying to unite with the soul and the body. So in the unification, it's going to conceive and it's going to manifest the divine child, you know, the marriage between heaven and earth. It's going to manifest this new self. It is, the manifest self has the potential to realize the state of enlightenment. In my book, I call that the realized self, the enlightened, the one who reaches enlightenment. In G.R.S. Meade, you know, the ancient, what would you call him, classical?
The old theosophist.
Yeah. He referred to the permanent atom of experience in his writing, his commentary on the Hymn of the Robe of Glory. And this image is beautiful. A permanent atom of experience is the attainment of your true spiritual identity. In the Song of the Pearl?
Right.
There's that hint about our glorious destiny that awaits us if we collect enough of these permanent atoms of experience. They get collected and put together to form the robe of glory. My image of this is that the robe of glory, which is the collection of our true spiritual identity over and over many experiences, it's really, it's like a psychoidal body that allows us to interface with any realm of existence, whether it's a physical realm, a psychic realm, or a spiritual realm. And it's a body that is free to move in and out of time and space at will. And it may sound like a fantasy, but I think that might be the goal that the spirit is working on, which is what the ordeals of being trapped in the mind and the body provide the spirit, the opportunity to do that kind of work. So that's why, you know, initiation is so important, because it's really helping us achieve our cosmic destiny, which is to become one with the divine, and that means all the things that go with being divine.
And Bob, you also in your book, you talk about the higher imagination that the Sufis, Gnostics, and other mystics refer to. What exactly is the higher imagination?
The higher imagination, you know, is where how you have a thing that's both the end result and the means toward that end result. I think in this case, we can understand the higher imagination, like what the Sufis refer to as the Gnostic imagination. But it's kind of a particular kind of a reality, or let's say a realm of being. It's a particular kind of psychic experience. It's got this kind of twofold side to it. Henry Corbin taught us that we use the higher imagination, you know, we use it to penetrate the other world, you know, to be able to penetrate that world and hold our own. It's kind of like a dreamlike state, but it's a lucid dreamlike state in which you retain your awareness, and you have the ability to make choices, while at the same time, you're experiencing this different world other than the one provided by your five senses. So, you know, on the one hand, the higher imagination is that world, that other world. But it's, I guess in that sense, it can be called psychoidal, because it's neither purely physical nor purely psychic, but it's kind of a mixture of the two. It is real. It's autonomous. It has beings and cultures, but we pretty much know it doesn't operate on a cause-effect rule or a time-space kind of paradigm. It's a reality above the senses and above the intellect, our rational intellect, but yet still below the realm of the pure spirit. You know, it's not the same as pure spirit. So it's in between.
Bob, far across time, both Plato and Jung talked about archetypes. How would you describe archetypes and their importance?
I would describe archetypes pretty much in the way Jung did. It's autonomous. They're autonomous collective forces that produce universal images. You see them in myths of all cultures. As if they're preformed patterns and themes in our psyche. They have their own agenda, though. If you look at, take for example the images of the Tarot, you look at those images and you see compelling images and themes, you know, like the Magician, the Hanged Man, the Devil, you know. These are archetypal images. They're not just ordinary images. And Jung recognized these images as having their own life, if you will. They have a will, different than our conscious ego, and you have tremendous influence on our minds, our bodies. I think you can see the archetypes in the zodiac, the zodiacal rulers, you know, Gemini and Libra and Sagittarius and so forth. The planets and the astrology are archetypal. Gnostics understood this. You know, they understood that these are the rulers of destiny. They govern the realm in which we're living. And they call them the archons, because they're perceived as the adversaries, because these archons challenge us, you know. They definitely interfere with our plans.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they do serve a useful purpose, though, in providing us with the initiatory ordeals that we've been talking about today that awaken us to our true condition, like in the Matrix movie. When Neo wakes up to his condition and the condition of humanity, oh my God, it's shocking.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's what the archons have put us in, to that situation, and we're there until we wake up. and free ourselves from their grip. You know, that's the goal of individuation, is to be freed from their control and learn how to see through them and, again, find the appropriate place for them to express within life, you know, but not to be controlled by them.
Bob, why did Jung consider alchemy an important tool for the representation of individuation?
Well, there's a great Jungian writer on alchemy named Jeffrey Raff. I recommend his books to your audience, you know. But his work, Jung and the Alchemical Imagination, describes a lot about alchemy and related to Jung. He talks about the Sufi mystical tradition, which preceded Western European alchemy. They viewed alchemy as a spiritual operation that emerged from visionary states and visionary experiences. So this altered state kind of concept comes up again and again in talking about Jung. The alchemists, you know, worked to unite spirit and matter, but the matter they were working with was more the substance of the psychic matter, psychic mind, which is, you know, a form of subtle matter. But they were, you know, these alchemists were interacting with beings from the psychoidal realm, and they had a goal, you know. I think the Sufi mystics were attempting to create spiritual bodies, you know. In the alchemy of the West, we have more, you know, as typical of the West, stages, you know, the idea of developmental stages, of transmutation that would, you know, basically these stages have to occur to complete the symbol of wholeness, the philosopher's stone. Because in the beginning, you have the idea of the stone as complete but not united. And the work is, okay, so that, what is that saying? Complete but not united means it's everything's there that you need. You're not lacking anything. Complete, but it's not organized, it's not united, and that's the work of alchemy, and of course, by extension, the individuation process. The alchemists went through these steps. They reduced their substances to the primal state, and then they would separate them out, you know, one from the other. They'd put sulfur over here and mercury over here, and then they'd operate on these substances in whatever way, and then attempt to reunite them at some point. What are they doing? They're trying to integrate and organize all the parts and bring about a unification. You know, this pattern, you see it in alchemy, of separating and uniting over and over. That's the work, you know. And Jung understood this pattern is that's what psychological work is. And that's the psychological path to wholeness. First of all, in Jungian psychology, it's very compatible to recognize that the raw material you're going to be working with emerges out of visionary states. You know, that's not uncommon. He had his practice called the active imagination practice, which he used to interact with dream figures or with beings from the psyche that he interacted with, or the psychoid. And that's the psychic material. And it even could include your emotional states or fantasies that are gripping your mind, you know, some kind of a compulsion that you feel you must carry out. These are states of mind, states of consciousness, and they become the alchemical material that you're going to work on. And so first you reduce it to its primary state. You know, you learn to see what it is, and you separate it out from other psychic material, you know. So this is this, not that. This belongs to me, not this. And so in this way, you know, if you're in therapy or in analytic psychology, the doctor and the patient analyze the material that's coming up. Over the course of time, you learn to put it back together again in a new way. So that the you know, the separation's going on, the uniting is going on over and over. And I think in that way, the conscious and the unconscious are being united. And they're learning to work together as a team, cohesively. And eventually, I think the confrontations between the conscious and the unconscious become productive. And you reach the second stage of transmutation, and there's a union between the conscious and the unconscious. It's like a marriage. It's in Jung's work on the psychology of the transference, he analyzed these images that were written by the alchemists, and it showed the marriage of the king and the queen, and the sexual union of the king and the queen, and then the conception and of a new life, you know. And when you reach that stage, you've got the self being conceived and birthed. That's where the image of wholeness is united with the image of God. You know, it becomes one and the same. And it's all happening within you. It's pretty amazing. And
so I'm assuming you probably, like me, believe that the Gnostic attitude, I guess for lack of better words, is very important for the Western culture in these tenuous times. Could you explain how it can help our situation?
As I've already mentioned, first of all, the idea of the God image is so different that would be healing in and of itself to recognize that the source of our being is a loving community that is working together to unite their will and create things out of love. I mean, that's the model of individuation. And, you see, in another Gnostic myth, it's in the Nag Hammadi Library, it's called the Sophia of Jesus Christ. You see this fantastic image of the divine beings coming together. They come together, they're called the Assembly of the Eighth. And the text talks about how they come together to gather to find the unity of their will. The idea here is that they're resolving differences and they're finding room for everything. Now imagine that's your God image. That's what that's the being that you call God right there. Now that's going to have a profoundly different impact on how you evaluate what's important. You see. So I mean, I think right there the Gnostic tradition in the God image would offer a healing, therapeutic image to the Western cultures to see that. How important it is. So we could learn, instead of making war and, you know, running around trying to dominate the planet and rape the environment and get all the, you know, products we can make for sale, and it's all based on fear, it's all based on greed. This is killing us, you know. We're killing ourselves, we're killing the planet. So, and we seem to have it all justified in our mind, you know, with a Western Judeo-Christian tradition, as if we're entitled to do this. So I think the Gnostic tradition offers a radically different view of what life is for and what life is about and what we're supposed to be doing with it. And that would be healing right there, just that one little piece, you know. Not to mention all the other things we've been talking about today with the initiation rites and everything, if more people would personally confront their unconscious and the shadow side and everything else, there would be more reflection going on as to what I'm about to do. Is this really good? Do I want to go this direction with my life? At least you'd have an ethical pause inserted into choice making. And if you apply that principle to business, to politics, to science, education, everything. I mean, imagine, it would be just, to me, be so different. And it wouldn't be Pollyanna because, you know, these initiation rites and this individuation work is hard work. It's hard work. So we're talking about becoming a society of adults, you know, grow up, stop being, you know, children and really self-centered, egocentric children, and grow up and assume responsibility for our lives and shape the world, you know. And this is, I think, what is offered in this tradition of self-knowledge.
Well said. And to end things, Bob, will you tell us a little bit about your online Gnostic community, thepearl.org?
Thepearl.org is both an online community and it's an actual flesh and blood community on the planet Earth. there's, you know, the Pearl www.thepearl.org is there as a resource for people to read some Gnostic scriptures, to read some articles on Gnosis, to reflect on the message of Gnosis. I think we have some music on there with some nice contemporary sounding hymns. There's some icons that are put on there for contemplation. And, you know, it stands on the website, it kind of stands for a front porch for people to come and sit down and just take a look at things and see what's there. And we get letters or emails, I guess, from people who are checking out the website, and they find an interest, and they ask questions, and they want to study some more, and they want to maybe do a study course. So they'll write to us and ask, you know, how do I go a little further with this? And then we get back to them and try to offer, you know, what they need in the way of furthering their journey. And for those people who want more, they can come to the actual human flesh and blood community in San Diego, actually Encinitas, California, where we meet. We have ritual ordination services. We have these, you know, we've been talking about these rites of initiation all day.
Right.
And that we have those. And we also have public meetings that are not threatening to people. It's a vibrant community. I like to call ourselves spiritual athletes because we take the spiritual life very seriously, but seriously doesn't translate into somberness. It's a top priority, but it's a lot of fun. So we have all kinds of different meetings that we gather at different times of the month for fast, breaking the fast, or book study, or scripture study, or maybe there's some kind of a holy day that we're celebrating. And we'll, you know, we have prayers, we'll sing, we'll chant, we'll have a little discussion, there's a little preaching, you know. Very psychologically astute preaching, I might add.
Ah, there you go. Yeah, I figured that much talking to you.
And this is our community. And then for those who want more, they can go, you know, they can ask for immersion. And from that point, they begin a course of study and growth that lasts a lifetime, basically. And you're continuing to grow in Gnosis and grow in your responsibilities with Gnosis. It's all very exciting.
Yeah, it seems like it. Definitely check it out. Well, Bob, I think that should do it for today. I'd like to thank you very much for taking your time and appearing on the show.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I do love your website. I think it's
thank you.
So original and fun, not boring, and well-presented. It has so many different kind of mediums to it that capture your imagination. So.
Oh, appreciate it. Appreciate it. Thank you. We're all doing what we can to spread the light, all in our own way.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and have a good day, and good luck with your book.
Thank you, Miguel.
Our fathers were our models for God. If our fathers failed, what does that tell you about God?
Abraxas offers you something so much more profitable, and it has to do with our ongoing topic, mythology. And why not? Why not believe all of this? Why not unbelieve all that you've been taught? For some weird reason, we tend to seek the spiritual, the liberating, in the material world itself. So something has to be made of matter to be divine? Makes no sense. Oil and water, truth seekers. Honestly, in my human incarnation, with my own two eyes, I have witnessed miracles, the supernatural, and even UFOs. So what? I gain more gnosis standing on craggy cliffs like a titan's jaws, watching the sun melt into the cerulean Atlantic Ocean, the salt breath of the waves and the call of seagulls, a symphony of catharsis. I learn more about the godly from the smile of a child than I would watching some dude walk on a lake. I know cosmic joy when looking at some hot chick in high heels and hip huggers leaning over a jukebox picking out an old Doors song. The supernatural means nothing to the Gnostic, for we are older than the moon and the stars, older than magic and the gods, older than even Fidel Castro. We dreamers want to go beyond all of this. And believe it or not, mythology is a fountainhead of blissful freedom, my truth seekers. Am I starting to ramble, Ewan?
Let's go, I'm bored, let's go.
Okay, like I proclaimed last week, mythology has been corrupted today to simply mean a fable, a lie, a fairy tale, but it is far more than mere fiction, and there are people who explain it in wiser terms than I could. As June Singer said in her awe-inspiring and touching book, A Gnostic Book of Hours, myths are true expressions of our inner selves, revealed cryptically in image, symbol, and metaphor. They are something like dreams. Rationally, they may not ring true, but in a psychological sense, they express people's inner processes through the use of ingenious devices that conceal what must be concealed and reveal what must be revealed. And as Abraxas is saying, myth is a star that is constant yet surreal in our voyages through the seas of fate. Myth is the field, the living dream in which you will find your true self and know that you are actually a star. Myths reveal a deeper, personal truth in the form of a story, and all our lives are just but stories. As Heinrich Zimmer said, the best things can't be told. They are transcendent, inexpressible truths. The second best things are misunderstood, and they are the myths, which are metaphoric attempts to point the way towards the first. And the third best things have to do with history, science, biography, and so on. Sorry, Orthodox Jesus, you're down to the third best thing. Like Meister Eckhart said, it is of more worth to God that Christ should be born in the virgin soul than that Jesus should have been born in Bethlehem. And that's the Gnostic Jesus, laughing like the trickster that he is, dancing and joyous and free, peeling off his lower self once he puts away childish things. Alan Moore said that all history is fiction. A good Gnostic I know once told me that if you search for historical truth, your thirst will never end. But if you just search for the truth, your history will never end. I wonder if that's actually an original of him, or did he plagiarize it from someone? He never told me, but maybe Indra will send his lawyers to teach me a lesson.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.
Stefan Heller, in his book, Gnosticism, New Light on the Ancient Tradition of Inner Knowledge, states that, and I quote, myth does not mean stories that are not true, but rather stories that embody truths of a different order than the dogmas of theology or the theories of philosophy, unquote. The wonderful Timothy Freke and Peter Gandhi explain in The Jesus Mystery that, quote, in antiquity, myth did not mean something untrue as it does for us today. Superficially, a myth was an entertaining story, but to the initiated, it was a sacred code that contained profound spiritual teachings. Plato comments that if one looks as if those who established rites of initiation for us were no fools, but that there is a hidden meaning in their teachings. Those who practice myths have given their lives to true philosophy and will grasp the hidden meaning.
Sometimes you have to lose yourself before you find anything.
So, why don't we wonder, what is the hidden meaning in Star Wars, The Matrix, Halo 2, or even Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Well, I tell you what, the hidden meaning is much better than the stale teachings of Orthodox religion. And you can take that to the bank, truth seekers. And how can we talk about myth without bringing in the beautiful Joseph Campbell? Easy. We can't, and we won't. Campbell described myth as being transparent to transcendence. That is exactly what the Tao, or the Gnostic Pleroma is. The eternal light that flows through the bubble that is all of reality. It encompasses and it is not part of reality. It is everywhere, but it is nothing. Campbell also said that the first function of a living mythology is to reconcile consciousness to the precondition of its own existence, that is to say, to the nature of life. The first function of a mythological order has been to reconcile consciousness to this fact. Myth also reconciles existence with gratitude, with love, with recognition of the sweetness. A mythological order is a system of images that gives consciousness a sense of meaning in existence, which has no meaning. It simply is. There is no meaning to existence.
My God, it's full of stars.
Now, isn't that true freedom? There is no meaning to life. There doesn't have to be. It just is. And to the Gnostic, the meaning of life is beyond life, in the place we call the treasury of light. Continuing with Campbell, the second function of mythology, then, is to present an image of the cosmos that will maintain your sense of mystical awe and explain everything that you come into contact with the universe around you. And for those of you who scoff at religions or faith, Campbell said that ritual is simply myth enacted. By participating in a rite, you are participating directly in a myth. I recall also that Campbell did say that you can make anything into a ritual, and thus you can learn to live in the myth, just as long as you are conscious, aware, and awake. In other words, smoking can be a ritual, as can be a simple walk through your neighborhood park. But Campbell also mentioned that religion is myth, misunderstood, and corrupted. And lastly, Joseph Campbell said that myths derive from the visions of people who have searched their own most inward world. Now, isn't that the Gnostic position? Isn't that the position of those who enter the mystery schools? Isn't that the position of the wise man of any religious order? And my favorite Joseph Campbell quote, which I mentioned in my first show, and is extremely important, is the mind the vehicle of consciousness, or is consciousness the vehicle of the mind? And at the end of the day, getting that awe we lost as children is truly and probably the greatest reason to have myth.
I wish none of this had happened.
So do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us.